In the fireside room this morning, we have Janet Larson. Today's session number is 98.5, and it's titled Poetry and Hospitality. Let's listen in.
And I'm out here from New Jersey, and I'm about to go back tomorrow, very reluctantly. And I'm finishing up a series of sessions on poetry that is biblically grounded in some way. Last week we did psalms and laments and poems, and this week on the various themes of Guide Our Feet. And I wanted to end with poems of hospitality. I'm defining hospitality in a very broad sense here in order to get in the poems I want to read. But actually makes sense to me, and I hope somehow that might communicate itself to you, and or you'll see connections that I didn't see. Poems of hospitality in the Guide Our Feet little handbook, study guide, explains that hospitality has to do with more than inviting people over for dinner or giving the man on sweeping your sidewalk, as I did the other day, a cold drink. It's not just things like that exactly. It's what maybe a gesture like that means in a broader sense, a sense of compassion and connectedness with the rest of the world and with other people who may be strangers, aliens, as well as your friends. When we think of hospitality, we think of inviting our friends over for dinner or something, I suppose. I'm going to sort of redefine this as poems of hospitality equals poems of love and vision. And that those are the two key ingredients that you need to have to be hospitable. Obviously, both love and vision are things that come from elsewhere, are gifts that we have are entrusted with, and gifts that need to be practiced or put into practice somehow. Now, I want to start out the way I did yesterday when we talked about wrestling, to ask you, what are your images of hospitality? What do you think of in terms of things you do or things you would see in your mind's eye that the word hospitality brings up? Martha Stewart?
Please, just when you say
free associate.
Immediately when you said that, I thought of the hospitality of Abraham. There's an icon of that which shows the three angels that came to visit Abraham and Sarah at the Oaks of Mamre.
Yeah.
And gave the prophecy that Sarah would have a son. Oh, well, mm-hmm. I don't know if it said son or not, but yes, a baby. An heir.
So, what happens in that story?
They served a meal.
Abraham and Sarah were entertaining angels unawares. And not just any meal, right? Best stuff?
Kill the cat.
Kill the cow.
And I think Abraham has something to do with that meal, too, doesn't he?
Yeah, he took care of the cat.
Okay.
Actually, the basic point of that, one that strikes me is that Abraham set aside his own priorities.
Just the angels arrive out of nowhere, as things tend to happen in those Abraham and Sarah stories. Boom, there they are. And he just responded, okay. Even though they didn't quite know who these people were. Okay.
That's also a key one in the chapter in prefacing our faith, because the guests turn out to be the hosts. There's the kind of switch and transformation.
Okay. I'm going to have to erase the gospel here. Erase that too, just so that's on the board by itself. Okay.
No.
The guest and the host change roles. Okay, good. Any other images that come to mind? They don't have to be biblical necessarily, though they might be.
The one that I think of the word orientation, to be invited into whatever is going on involves a certain amount of information about what's going on. So I think of it as hospitality when I say to Jordan, okay, now today, do you remember what's going to happen? We're going to da 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 da. Or when someone came in this morning to the session and someone said, here, we're on 641.
Yes, and you handed me that sheet. That was hospitable.
Oh, I thought it was probably embarrassing. But I was trying.
Sorry, it didn't work. Yeah, well, that's exactly filling them in. Any other images that come to mind?
I just, in general, I just think of making people feel welcome.
All right.
Yes. Just whatever, and to deal with their specific needs.
All right, attentive, paying attention, asking them what they need, because you don't always necessarily know, especially if someone's staying overnight. When I was in Wenatchee, before I came up here, I stayed with a family, Grace Lutheran Church, and they were at my service. I needed to go to the drugstore, they took me to the drugstore. If I needed time out to work on some, you know, work on my presentation, they gave me that time, told me the best place to sit, where there wouldn't be so much wind on their deck. You know, they're just very thoughtful and attentive to what I needed. They saw my papers blowing around, said, go over here. You know, that is very, it was just very thoughtful. It was small things, attentiveness. What else?
Just more basic with hospitality, I think of home or something that is my own, that is given or shared.
Home is shared, okay. Anything else?
An image that I have is a tall coffee table.
Coffee?
No, a tall coffee table, one that's like this,
yeah.
Because like they have in Europe, I want one, and I've wanted one forever, and someday I'll get one. Mm-hmm. But that's what they have in Europe, and everybody that we've ever visited is so hospitable. I just have learned so much about hospitality from those people whose coffee tables I've sat around.
So every hospitality needs a coffee table.
A tall one, yeah.
Why does it have to be tall? I'm just curious.
I don't know, because they always have their furniture. I went to a school there, and even students, you know, in their little dorm rooms, if you didn't have anything else, mm-hmm. you might have a hard chair, but you had a coffee table.
Yeah, you can eat off it because it's high enough.
I see.
As opposed to bending over.
Everybody gathers around, you always gather chairs around the coffee mm-hmm. table. Mm-hmm. And then that's a welcome hospital.
All right. There's food is shared.
Oh, feasting, absolutely.
Feasting, even if it is just coffee, to me that's a feast. Can you gather around together that bounty that's being shared? Okay.
See, our coffee tables are there only to display books that we probably have. Impress people with what we read, and there is actually there to share.
Yeah, books are in the way. Were you going to say something?
The guest part of that hospitality is enjoying whatever they have and offer you.
Right. If you don't like it.
Yeah.
See,
I mean, the way to be hospitable to your host is to try and enjoy what they have.
Okay. That's a good point. We're running out of ink here.
Absolutely.
But there's a reciprocity about it. And so in thinking about hospitality, we can think about ourselves as guests as well as hosts. Why not think about it from both sides?
Uh-huh. I think openness. Uh-huh. To people who are different than we are.
I think the word open is important. It's an attitude, it's a door, it's opening up your storehouse of goods for another. It's opening. Now, I wanted to start with so these themes of love and vision, and they bring in some of these images by beginning with a poem by George Herbert on the top of this sheet. Oh. And the title of this poem is Love, and it uses very directly biblical imagery of being invited to a feast.
What are the dates for George Herbert?
You know, I'm sorry, I forgot to write them down.
Did he do Easter Wings?
It might have been John Donne. Okay. It's not my period, so okay. I can't recall who did which poem. He would be early 17th century. Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. I the unkind, ungrateful? Ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand, and smiling did reply, who made the eyes but I? Truth, Lord, but I have marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. And know you not, says love, who bore the blame? My dear, then I will serve. You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat. So I did sit and eat. Now this is about both the hospitable love character and the guest. What images do you see here that we've been talking about in this poem about hospitality and its spiritual sense?
It's an offer of food at the very end.
All right. And what is that feast? By the end of the poem, when he sits down to eat, what is he eating? What is he feasting on? It's an allegory kind of a poem.
It's the Eucharist?
Perhaps. What is
love?
Right. What does that mean for this character who's portrayed here in the poem, the speaker? What does that mean for him?
A transformation.
Into? From what to what?
Someone who is burdened with guilt and sin to someone who is redeemed.
Okay. That's right on. Who else would like to say what they see happening to the speaker in receiving hospitality? To hear it in another voice, in other words.
In the first line, my soul drew back, so the person, the author, is afraid of the encounter.
Yeah.
And afraid of the involvement.
Mm-hmm. Right. Too guilty to be here. The guilt is a barrier. Love says it's not. Love has the privilege of making that judgment, and it's interesting to me that love here is presented as a kind of female figure, and the character speaking in the poem presumably is George Herbert or something like the poet himself speaking in the first person. The biblical image behind this comes from a number of places. Of course, we remember the feasting, the parables of the kingdom, about the kingdom feast in the New Testament. But I'm also thinking of the figure of wisdom in Proverbs, in the first chapter, in the eighth chapter, where she invites, goes into the marketplace or goes into the public spaces and invites, and is a she, is personified as a she, the word for wisdom in Hebrew, as in Greek, is female. invites, and the personification is clearly female in the text too, invites men to come to her feast, and it's a feast of Torah, of knowledge of God. This is a figure that turns up a number of places in the Old Testament, and we don't hear about this much. Her opposite in Proverbs is folly, who invites men to the wrong kinds of feasting that don't give them anything but death. So love here has a long tradition behind her of this invitation. Only this is a Christian poem, so there's an implication that love is Christ as well. But the connection between wisdom, personified female in the Old Testament, and Jesus in the New is written into a layer of New Testament scripture that we don't often access. There's a book in the bookstore, for example, about it by Elizabeth Schuster Fiorenza called Jesus, Miriam's Prophet, Sophia's Child. If you're interested in this subject, it's utterly fascinating. At any rate, my point is, it's not surprising that we should find love in this form, identified both with wisdom and Jesus. And notice that the guest wants to deserve to be the guest. You know, when we make up our party list, do we sit there and think, do I want that person at my party? Do they deserve to be here? I had a house blessing earlier in the summer and have limited space and had to decide who to invite. I had about 35 people I wanted to invite initially, but that was far too many to fit in these spaces because we had to go into each room and bless them. And there was one person from my church I don't really care for too much, but I thought her feelings be hurt. She wasn't invited. Maybe I should get to know her a little better anyway. So I invited her. She was a very delightful guest to have. And it furthered our relationship a little bit more. Even though there were other people on the list I wanted to invite more. It's hard to decide. Well, this guest feels guilty. And love says deserving is not the issue. Deserving is not the issue. The other thing here that I think is interesting is that the guest is worried about looking. You cannot look on me. Did you imagine this guest looking down, downcast? And she answers boldly, this love, like as John was saying about shalom practices, this love is persistent. She won't hear no for an answer. She takes my hand and smiling did reply, who made the eyes but I? So try again, honey. That argument didn't work. How wonderful this is. Think of yourself as the guest to be accepted like this. Unconditionally by love, by divine love. And then think of yourself as having been accepted in that way, becoming the host or hostess. How do you act? What is your practice?
In the second line where the host said, by quick-eyed love, observing Negro slack, and I think that's really being attuned to the needs of your guests. And trying to fulfill those needs.
Yeah. I don't. Conversations. I have trouble relating much to my guests at parties because I'm so busy doing all the Martha stuff.
Right.
And it's probably true that sometimes you are so busy being attentive to that you don't get much out of it in terms of new ideas or a great conversation about something. It's just sort of the way it is, and you are serving them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The whole tone of the poem, and that probably part of it's the way you read it, is there's such a gentleness, though, in this invitation. The words, the sweetly, and smiling, all the while the invitation is being gently offered. This person is not being bludgeoned into coming. There's a gentleness, but yet that persistence that will not really let them sit.
Yes. You must sit down, said love. Very persistent, but gentle at the same time. and taste my meat. Now, hospitality, if you think of it as a practice of love, it probably is also necessary to feel loved in order to be truly hospitable, like this. I have another poem that's not on a paper.
Or maybe if you don't feel loved, to act loving at least.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes you simply get into the motions to make it true.
Get into the what?
Get into the motions.
That make it true.
I mean, you were not clear that you wanted her, but you acted in a way that was loving.
Yeah.
And in fact, it blossomed.
Yeah, right.
So I know how important the feelings are, but I...
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's where practice comes in. It practices, practice. Practice isn't perfect. Now all the things are in place. This is a poem by Rilke called She Who Reconciles. And this seemed to me about hospitality too, only it's about an individual. It certainly spoke to me as a single woman who does spend a great deal of her time at home without having guests. But here there is another kind of hospitality, a kind of openness of the heart, that is another ingredient of what we might mean by hospitality. She who reconciles the ill-matched threads of her life and weaves them gratefully into a single cloth. It's she who drives the loud mouths from the hall and clears it for a different celebration, where the one guest is you, Rilke speaking to God. Where the one guest is you. In the softness of evening, it's you she receives. You are the partner of her loneliness, the unspeaking center of her monologues. With each disclosure, you encompass more, and she stretches beyond what limits her to hold you. That's hospitality, isn't it? And that could apply to anyone who is in a life of contemplation or prayer with God. With each disclosure on her part, you encompass more, and she stretches beyond what limits her to hold you. Now, hospitality is about going out. It's also about vision, I think. And one way to think about it is it could flow out of a relationship to the world which sees beyond the surfaces of things, maybe beyond the faces we don't like to look at, beyond the things that just seem like things, to the harmony in creation and to God's presence in it. Divine vision, one of my basic tenets here in these talks, is that imagination is a divine gift. We all have it. You do not have to be a great architect or a sculptor or a dancer to have imagination. And without it, we can't be hospitable. You can't figure out what your guests need without imaginatively extending yourself, or as Rilke poem says, stretching yourself, stretching your limits. Especially if you don't know your guests very well, or they are totally strangers. This is from Hildegard of Bingen. It's not exactly her words, but this book is in the bookstore. This book isn't, but it's called The Journal of Hildegard of Bingen. It's a novel based on her writings. And she's a 12th century mystic. Anybody familiar with her? Some people are? Okay. I just love the way this book opens. She had visions, and she was also an enormously busy, practical person. Running her convent, composing music for the services, and counseling her, she calls them raw recruits, to the convent, and collecting herbs and doing all kinds of things. So for her to have a vision suggests that she had an orientation to life that enabled this to happen. The last vision was more like a visitation. It was so fleeting. simple, direct, and wordless in the few seconds I allowed for contemplation. Outside the casement, the windows open. Outside the casement, I saw the broad sycamore once again shorn of leaves, its branches grappling the winter sky, its base solidly in the earth. Suddenly, the tree began physically to move in the quiet light of midday. Its motion seemed such that I and everything I knew or could imagine was present in that tree and shared the same fluid, energetic breathing. And then the glimpse is gone and she goes back to being busy again. Now what would that have to do with hospitality? Any thoughts?
Seeing yourself in the other.
Seeing yourself in the other? She's losing herself. All her agendas and lists and details momentarily. But it's just a finding herself at the same time in a larger sort of rhythm. It's not even a larger picture, it's a rhythm that she's part of. And how different that rhythm is from the rhythm of going to the grocery and getting the things you need and making your, you know, your fish sauce with gin in it or whatever. It just, I mean, when I gave that party, I had so many lists of things to do. But this rhythm is different and she has time for it, and it makes all the difference in how she runs that convent, welcomes visitors, everything that she does.
Maybe she didn't have time for it. And you just give it to her as a gift.
Well, you get that impression sometimes, the way this is written. Now, this is a novelist who knows her work really well, but she says later, public responsibilities cloud my inner life until it is nearly invisible. So, yes, it is certainly a gift. But she is also living in the discipline of a lot of spiritual practices that, you know, it's almost like you do this over here and then this happens over here. And, you know, make the connection. So with some of those opening bits, like you just, let's see what's on the inside of this. Oh, you know what, that one disappeared. I think that one, the one I want to read to you next, went off yesterday with some other poem on the other side of it. O Taste and See by Denise Levertov. The world is not with us enough. You know, this is a takeoff on Wordsworth's sonnet, The World is With, The World is Too Much With Us. Can you recite it? The world is too much with us, late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. She says, the world is not with us enough. Oh, taste and see, the subway Bible poster said, meaning the Lord. Meaning, if anything, all that lives to the imagination's tongue, grief, mercy, language, tangerine, weather, to breathe them, bite, savor, chew, swallow, transform into our flesh, our deaths. Crossing the street, plum, quince, living in the orchard and being hungry and plucking the fruit. Now, it's hard to follow her syntax. This is a list of all the things that live to her imagination's tongue. Feasting sort of begins for her in the feast of imagination, taking in the world, consuming it. And in the process of this poem, she is, I think, saying that imagination is a divine gift because it is what gives you the connection with the things in the world. And of course, the people as well. Living in that way, you taste the world, and you see, and without seeing, there can't be this identification with the other. And also, I mean, hospitality has to do with having fun and enjoyment, right? Sitting around that coffee table, you're enjoying things that are pleasurable along with the fellowship. Nothing puritanical about it at all. And, oh, taste and see the Lord in the Bible, she would have understood as part of the affirming worldview of the Hebrew Bible, affirming of the created world and all the pleasures that it has. We kind of forget about that. Denise Levertov had a Jewish father and a Russian Jewish father and a Welsh mother. And I think it's coming especially from that Russian Jewish side, is her appreciation of the things of this world that would make it possible for her to write this kind of poetry. So she's taking O Taste and See the Lord, which might be actually a kind of evangelical Bible poster, and extending what the meaning of the Lord is. Let's look at another poem that is on the back of the sheet I just gave you. Love calls us to the things of this world. Part of this is, these are not pictures of people offering hospitality here in these poems, but about what the quality of love is and how it deeply transforms all of your relationships. And the wisdom, getting back to that image of wisdom in the first poem, the wisdom that love's openness to the things that are given can bring for you. It's a new idea in the ending of this poem that goes beyond what Denise Levertov is saying in O Taste and See. By the way, I think her poetry's in the bookstore too. Richard Wilbur was our poet laureate back in 1987. Anybody familiar with his poems? He is a marvelous poet, and he's won the Pulitzer Prize, etc., etc. But this poem is particularly meaningful to me. The love calls us to the things of this world, by the way, is a line from St. Augustine's commentary on the Psalms, which I began my series with. Psalms call us to love the things of this world because, and to love God in them. The eyes open to a cry of pulleys, and spirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment, bodiless and simple as false dawn. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Some are in bed sheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly there they are. Now they are rising together in calm swells of halcyon feeling, filling whatever they wear with the deep joy of their impersonal breathing. Now they are flying in place, conveying the terrible speed of their omnipresence, moving and staying like white water. And now of a sudden, they swoon down into so rapt a quiet that nobody seems to be there. The soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember, from the punctual rape of every blessed day, and cries, "Oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands in the rising steam, and clear dances done in the sight of heaven." Yet, as the sun acknowledges with a warm look the world's hunks and colors, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice as the man yawns and rises, Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone, and the heaviest nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance. Mm-hmm. Now, to understand this poem, you need to understand how they do laundry in urban environments. Do you know about the pulleys? Okay. This is my joy of my life, is to have a pulley of my own in my new place, but it's very hard to work, and the clothes kind of droop down awfully far, and I worry about them dropping into the neighbor's yard. The Italian folks on the other side get those pulleys out there day and night. They've got their laundry out there in the rain. They've got laundry, and they never drop anything. They know how to do it. So this is awakening in the city to a sound. Imagining this laundry. I don't know if you've ever watched laundry floating and doing different dances, but it's probably all done that sometime. This is the vision. This is a vision in a state of half-awakening. And then the vision changes, and the person is beginning to get up. And I don't think at all that Richard Wilbur is endorsing a soul-body split here. But there is a moment when you're not thinking of those feet that have to get, crank themselves over the edge of the bed like I had to do this morning, and put them on the ground and actually accept your waking life. And that's, at this moment, the voice changes. And the soul descends in bitter love. It's a mixed bag to accept the waking body. And the soul rises with the body, rises in every sense of that word. And then there is a generous, it's a little bit like let there be light, let there be this in the Hebrew Bible, first chapter of Genesis. Bring them down. You know, let it be as it is. Bring them down. We can't have celestial dances all the time. People need clothes. Lovers, thieves, and nuns. And this is clearly quickly becomes a kind of allegorical statement about the difficult balance required in life. What? Between the soul and the body, between vision and practicality. Which is the sort of delicate balance you're keeping as a hostess when you're trying to remember the purpose of your gathering and the meaning of your acts, as well as all the practical necessities of the day. I'd like to hear somebody tell me what they think this poem means. My students, mostly Roman Catholics and lapsed Catholics, whenever they get to those dark habits, think of the secret vices of the nuns that taught them in grade school and high school, get off and think this is some kind of critical poem about the clergy. I don't really think it is. But, you know, I think Wilbur knows he's using language in tricky ways, so that could be part of it. And I invite you also to look for images of hospitality, of the things we put on the board or spoke of.
In a way, it's finding holy moments in the mundane.
Yes.
Task of life, which we need to do.
And as with Hildegard, it just happens. And it's in both cases a matter of vision, of actually seeing things. All of these poems in some way have vision in common.
Yeah.
Okay, good. What else do you see in this?
The vision of hospitality that I see is that the laundry is identified as not just for us, but it's for those marginalized. Mm-hmm. For the backs of thieves.
Yeah.
Sort of
a generous vision here.
Generous.
Not concerned at the moment for prisons, building more prisons or arresting more drug addicts. I mean, it's drug dealers. It's just, let there be laundry. Part of my agenda is to encourage all those people who are either on laundry duty up here at Holden or who will have to go back home soon to laundry duty to think of it in a spiritual way.
Uh-huh. I think reinforces what he said is the line, the sun acknowledges with a warm look the world's hunks and colors. There's the from one end to the other, and I think there are days actually when we're hunks, and then there's other days when we're colors. not hunks in the sense of guys that are hunks, but that word just right,
yeah.
Hunk.
Yeah,
oh, hunk boy, the hunk.
And all of that is accepted here.
Yeah, it's all embraced.
It's what we would call up here at Holden these days an expansive poem, an expansive vision, an attitude toward life. And it's difficult to keep your balance, isn't it? To keep your spiritual balance in the world, or the real world that you really live in, and where all of these demands are pressing every day. Other comments?
I think it's talking about transcendence and imminence. It's a good word.
Go on.
The first vision is sort of a transcendent vision,
mm-hmm.
of the spirit world.
Mm-hmm.
But then the second part is the imminence of God being involved in the world.
All right. We need to be involved but not lose that vision of transcendent. It is, it's very Lutheran, like many of these poems are totally not Lutheran, but they are in some way. I mean, there is this transcendence and immanence together, and that's part of what the difficult balance is about, theologically speaking. And for all of us, it's a real practical struggle every day. Any other comments you'd like to make on this poem?
I think one of the neatest phrases is, oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry.
Yeah.
Nothing but rosy hands and the rising steam and clear dances done in the sight of heaven. In contrast to what laundry really is, a pile of dirty clothes that seems to stack up and you have to keep doing it over and over and over again. It never ends.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting to think about laundry as being somehow connected.
I think it was easier to connect though back when we used to hang clothes out on the line.
Yeah,
I think that's true. Now with the outside, you have the sun shining in the earth.
It's a wonderful image, that picture of people hanging laundry.
Yeah. I think also it's in their perspective of a poet that this poet sees laundry and is able to conjure up all these images and ideas. Someone else might just see the work and such. Same thing as if a person with a certain perspective is walking through a forest and sees a leaf falling, they might think about their life or in context to that leaf, where someone else might just not even pay attention. So it's kind of paying attention and approaching the kind of what you were saying, finding holy moments in the mundane, but just kind of being open to kind of seeing things in a different way, in a poetic way, so that you can think in different ways, I guess.
And this is so much of what the Psalms that celebrate the earth are about. You know, the particularity, the homes for the conies and the rocks and the trees full of sap and the different things in the world, the leviathans that play in the sea. They're all there and they're all things, and you could study them, you know, or you could notice them or not notice them, but the psalmist sees them all as expressions of God. And that vision is a gift. Those eyes of faith that love me, and it's seeing and loving at the same time. And this poem is full of moments of difficult balance that are, in a way, the poise of faith. So I just pull out one line that always throws my students in. But your soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember, from the punctual rape of every blessed day. I mean, it's almost a swearing there. Every blessed day. And yet, every blessed day. You have to read it twice. Both contained in that same word, which is one reason we like poetry and need poetry, I think, to help us keep those double meanings alive. Just yesterday we did a poem that talked about the angel fights with us. It's both on our side and as our antagonist as we struggle with God about some issue. There are these puns, double meanings, paradoxes in faith.